I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Jose Rivera. He's a research scholar at the Center for Regional Studies at the University of New Mexico and a professor of planning at the School of Architecture and Planning. And he's author of the book Acequia Culture, Water, Land, and Community in the Southwest, published by the University of New Mexico Press, which has also been translated into Spanish. And he is part of the Amigos Bravos Water Matters lecture series, which is happening the third Tuesday of every month, which means that on July 17th, he will be giving a lecture called The History and Importance of Acequias in New Mexico at the Randall Davies Audubon Center here in Santa Fe at 7 in the evening. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So the history of acequias goes back four centuries, and there's kind of celebration right now of our history on many levels going on here in New Mexico. And acequias have so many functions in the history of New Mexico, as you write about cultural and historic and political and so many. Let's just walk people through the beginning of the acequia system here in northern New Mexico. They were formed as part of the land grants. How were the land grants formed? Were they were certainly political boundaries. They were also, as I understand it, natural boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It was very important at the time, keeping in mind that the settlers that were recruited to come to New Mexico through the Camino Real, all the way from Mexico City and through places like Zacatecas and other provinces of northern Mexico, essentially had to have assurances that when they got here that they would have the resources necessary for economy, basically, to make a living. And so the major resource, of course, in an arid, semi-arid landscape was here, were the lands and the rivers. And so with that, the settlers were provided with concessions, if you will. They were called in Spanish concesiones de tierra, with which to establish a land-grant community, and with that, the water that would be needed to irrigate agricultural plots of land.
So the idea was really, from the point of view of Spain, to colonize this land with lots of people and to make it a place where they want to live. They need to have land, they need to have water. How were the people living? It was mainly agriculture, cattle, sheep?
Yeah, the basic strategy was to establish agricultural colonies, because in those days that was the economy. So to do that, people needed land on which to irrigate for the farming and growing of crops. But also they needed, as you mentioned, additional lands with which to graze their livestock and animals that were brought with them along the Camino Real. As we know, it was the Spanish-Mexican settlers that introduced livestock to the region, initially primarily sheep, but then cattle as well, goats and other small animals, and of course horses. So all of this required then a search for suitable land of the kind you described, that enough to have the natural boundaries and resources in those boundaries, to make this kind of a settlement and a community possible. There were already people, of course, living here, the Pueblos, as well as other indigenous groups like the Apaches and Navajos and the Utes. So that was another item that the initial settlers had to relate to, that essentially how to move into an area without taking up land that was already being used. This proved to be difficult sometimes, but primarily the settlers diverted the larger rivers and streams, and the Rio Chama, the Rio Pecos, and of course even the Rio Grande as the place to establish the settlements. We see this kind of a landscape still to this day. I like to think of the tributaries of the Rio Grande and the Rio Chama as basically the expansions of the Camino Real. We know the Camino Real is a physical, highway of how people got here in caravans and by foot and by other means. But once getting here, they distributed themselves out pretty much following the water as a highway and up to tributaries and establishing villages and communities along those tributaries.
Let's talk about the acequias themselves. So when you had an area that was going to be divided up among various people who were going to use the land for farming and sheep and so on, how did they, I mean, they just dug ditches essentially to form these acequias? How did it work?
Okay. The first task really was to find a place, a bend in the river perhaps, or some other kind of physical layout of the surrounding area, a place where a presa could be built. Presa, as we know, is the Spanish word for diversion dam. And this was the first public works project of the settlers who came in groups, was to find a location to build a diversion dam and then from there build the rest of the infrastructure. In particular, the main ditch, which is known as the Acequia Madre. So both of these became fairly large public works projects, and in fact were the first infrastructure that was built by the original settlers, even before the construction of the local church, as important as religion was at that time. Nonetheless, the building of the irrigation system by way of this presa and the Acequia Madre were their first public works projects. And interestingly, they worked these out amongst themselves. These were largely families not related to each other and had to work out arrangements, as or called in Spanish arreglos, on how they were going to divide the water and share the water once it was in the main irrigation canal. So very early on, it required a collaborative and cooperative, kind of arrangement.
So this is something that I think perhaps we have a lot to learn from our ancestors and countrymen here in New Mexico, which is there are places, as you say in your writing, where the only political and social structure was the acequias and the organizations that built around them. And it seems like they had a way of working out conflicts and a way of sharing that was quite admirable.
Yes, that's correct, because keeping in mind that in those days, with this goal of establishing these agrarian communities in the upper reaches of the Rio Grande and the tributaries to it, this was for very isolated and remote, kind of terrain. Keep in mind that Mexico City, the main seat of government, was 1,500 miles. The spiritual center was in Durango, in the northern part of now Mexico. And so really people, when they got here, had to fend for themselves. We did have a capital, of course, eventually Santa Fe as the capital city after the first capital at San Gabriel near the confluence between the Rio Chama and the Rio Grande. But even Santa Fe itself remained a pretty agrarian, agricultural community up until the late 18th century and perhaps even beyond. And so people in the outlying areas, with very primitive modes of transportation, largely horse and buckboard wagons and other kinds of wagons that took people to where they needed to go, still left them in very remote pockets of settlement. A lot of it was along canyons where valley bottomland could be found along the tributaries, and constructing these diversion dams and irrigation acequias, alongside of it on both banks of the river usually. But this remoteness then is what led to people forming essentially their own government. I like to think of acequias really as people's institutions. because that literally what they are and you know it's, and were in those times still, people electing their own leaders, people establishing their own rules, their own self-government essentially, and implementing and justice as you mentioned when there were conflicts along the ditch, the people had to mediate those conflicts directly. And even to this day, in a large county like Rio Riba County, for example, that's as large as the state of Connecticut, there's really only two municipalities, Española and Chama. The rest of the county is still rural. And in all of those places, the only form of local government, you know, beyond the county, you know, below the county level, are the acequias. The acequias manage the affairs for the ditch, but they also run the fire department, the mutual domestic, you know, members of the mutual domestic system are also acequia parciantes, and they're volunteers in the fire department. They serve on the boards of the libraries, they serve on the boards of the clinics. So,
to this day?
Yes, to this day, they run basically their own institutions, and this is out of a tradition of having to, you know, fend for themselves for these numbers of centuries.
We're talking to Dr. Jose Rivera. Now, what kinds of conflicts came up? I mean, acequias, irrigation ditches, irrigation canals. Water is the stuff of life, and if there's conflicts over it, there are some of the most serious conflicts there are.
You know, that's just why the... you know, vecinos or neighbors, as they referred to themselves in those days, had to work out these arrangements early on, these arreglos, not only just how to divert and distribute the water, but very importantly, how to share the water. Inevitably, in times of scarcity or low flows in the river, there would be conflicts over the water. So, but they were prepared for that. They had rules about that people should not water out of turn, that people should not waste water, they should conserve water. When the flows were pretty low, that they ought to share the water in a custom that's called repartimiento, basically, that in times of low flows, how do you distribute and share the water across the members in the ditch and then even across ditches. So they had these long-standing customs and traditions, and often when conflicts came up, that's how they would be settled. And yes, sometimes they had to be petitioned and brought before the alcalde, and sometimes up to the level of the governor of New Mexico. But alcaldes typically went by the principles that were already in place, and the local custom and tradition, which lawyers might refer to nowadays as customary law, because those were proven ways of how water could be shared and distributed in the community, and that's how the conflicts were decided, is what were the customs and the traditions that ought to be upheld.
Well, what were some of these customs and traditions? I mean, we're talking not only about dividing up water, but a real kind of social function that bound communities together.
Yeah, well, a major tradition was the actual maintenance of the system. We have this ritual in these acequias called the annual cleaning of the ditch, the limpia, as it's called in Spanish. And this is the time when at the start of the irrigation season or just before this irrigation season, the neighbors come out and they clean out the ditch, any debris, any boulders, any twigs or other items that may have fallen into the ditch in the course of the wintertime. These items are cleaned out, any silt that's accumulated as well. And this is a way of people making a connection with each other once again and talking about things that are important. You know, frequently they'll talk about how much snowpack is up in the mountains because that's going to be a predictor of the amount of flow that they can expect in the river and the stream and how much they'll be able to divert into their own fields. And so some very important issues are discussed on that day. And it's a time when, you know, the generations come out, certainly the elders and the people the officers who serve as ditch commissioners and the mayordomo, but also young people come out and help, especially if they have a family member who's not able to come to the ditch cleaning that day. Typically a younger member of the family comes and pitches in.
Did both men and women do the ditch cleaning?
In the early days, it was primarily men. Nowadays we see both men and women at ditch cleaning, and as a matter of fact, we see both men and women serving as officers of these ditches, either as commissioners or mayordomos. But in the earlier days, it was mostly the men.
Now, in terms of how the acequias were governed, how land was divided, how the rhythm of life went, I mean, we're talking of about a 400-year period, so it's not monolithic, but it seems like there's an interesting balance between between communal life and private life, you know, your family life and then your participation in the community. What did that look like?
It is a public and private. The public part of it really is what's held in common, if you will. And that is the infrastructure that made the system possible. It's the infrastructure for the presa, the infrastructure for the acequia madre. All of those are commons properties with easement rights on them that the irrigators use and maintain and operate. However, once the water in the ditch enters the farmer's field, the fields of the parciantes, that's a private piece of property. And so there is this tension as to, private versus public in terms of, for example, water rights and ability to, in state law of New Mexico, we know that water is a property or commodity that can be bought and sold in the marketplace. And the parciantes certainly have the ability to do that. But there are other counterbalances to that. For example, the state legislature in the year 2003 passed a state statute that now returns the power to approve or deny water transfers directly into the hands of the comisionados, the ditch commission in every community. So we see some checks and balances in terms of this public and private relationship that's there. The gains that are made, sales that are made off of the land, those are in the private area. I mean, the family is able to, retain any income that's made off of the farm, any sales at the farmers markets, or if they own livestock, any sale of livestock at the auctions. And these have been and still are important sources of supplemental income to families, because what we have here basically is, in New Mexico, is a mixed farm and ranch economy. It's difficult to make a living off of just the agricultural and farming of a small parcel or of land, but combined with some livestock that are able to graze up in the forested areas and the grazing areas and under permits with the U.S. Forest Service or on permits along private lands, leased land, and so forth during the summer, and then bring the livestock back home during the winter, and then they're able to graze on the fields or right on the property. And by then, some hay has been baled, and livestock then have a store of winter feed right there on the farm. So it really does take this combination of the farm and ranch economy to make a living in many of these communities.
We're talking to Dr. Jose Rivera. Now, going back to the 18th and 19th century, there were periods where the population grew beyond what even a good acequia system could support. What happened then?
That's a very good question, yeah. Basically, the neighbors knew early on, and the families knew, because, yes, the families did multiply. I mean, one of the early, cradles of settlement, if you will, was the Alcalde to Velarde stretch of the Rio Grande. just hundreds and hundreds of families eventually settled there. It was a very productive land. It was along the floodplain. It was, of course, the Rio Grande, the major stream, and the ability to divert water there by way of the presas. But as settlers outgrew that area, then younger members in the same family knew it was time to, you know, look for new land. So what they did is they wrote petitions, literally, to the governor and the alcaldes in the, you know, appropriate jurisdictions, petitioning for additional land. And often it went with a statement that the carrying capacity or the you know, farming and irrigation capacity of where they were from had already been exceeded, and that it was time to look for new lands to be developed. So it was only a matter of time before they crossed over the Sangre de Cristos, for example, and settled in the Mora Valley in the eastern side. And with that, they took their petitions to establish and get approval for new land grants, such as the Mora Land Grant, and new farming villages up and down the Mora River, and then other tributaries to the Mora as well. So that's basically what they did, is they looked for new places to settle.
Now, there is a significant ecological benefit to acequias, and you said something that I found so interesting in one of your essays, which is that, in a way, in an acequia system, human beings become a keystone species, making all these other species' lives and habitats possible.
Yes, that's what scientists now are studying. You know, has to do with that. It's essentially the ecosystem values of acequias. Now, this is something that the elders, the old timers, the mayordomos, commissioners have known about all along. But interestingly enough, we see a new field of interest, you know, developing here. Sometimes refer to these as acequia studies. These are teams of scientists from New Mexico State University, the University of New Mexico, New Mexico Tech, and other universities around the state, New Mexico Highlands University, and some of the community colleges as well. I now have students and faculty members out in the field, you know, documenting the science of acequias, essentially. One item, for example, is the effects that acequias have on the water table, and there's been a scientific study done at Alcalde that documents that acequias recharge the aquifer, and beyond that, they also return flow of water to the river, you know, 2 or 3 months later. That was a study done by New Mexico State University, and it's widely cited nowadays as evidence and substantiation of this local knowledge about acequias. Beyond that, there are other teams of students, some at the University of New Mexico and some at other universities, studying the what I call the paisaje del agua, basically the water landscape, which is the riparian area that expands the possibility for plants and wildlife, you know, corridors alongside the river. The river bank is one thing, but once diverted by the ditches, usually both the left bank and the right bank, then it greatly expands this riparian area, or what we call this green belt, where things grow, and in doing so produces a habitat for wildlife, and also for plants and shrubs and cottonwoods to grow. We frequently see the tree line of cottonwoods and capulin and ciruela and other kind of smaller trees and shrubs growing right alongside the ditch bank. And this is part of what creates this paisaje, or this landscape of water in our river valleys.
It's such a beautiful picture that you paint. And I love it when you have a situation where what the old-timers have always known is then validated by these young, hard-working scientists. And it's great because it shows that there's so much wisdom in these cultures that we have around here that were very observant and very tied to the land. Were there water quality issues back in the day before industrial pollution?
Yes. As a matter of fact, these arreglos that we started to talk about, you know, these rules or regulations that people themselves would come together and adopt, you know, very early on, in fact, here in the city of Santa Fe, you know, even though it was a largely agrarian community, it was only a matter of time before, you know, you found debris, you found trash, you found discarded items, you found maybe just all kinds of pollutants, you know, in the bed of the acequia and eventually running in the water of the acequia itself. So the ordinances then took care of that. They adopted ordinances that the water in the ditch had to be clean, be kept clean and healthy, because earlier on, as a matter of fact, sometimes the water in the ditch was itself was the source of drinking water. So there was a great need to keep the water clean, even the water flowing in the acequias. And of course, there was always the need for water to you know, to give to livestock as well. So yes, they did have ordinances early on that today we could maybe even call them the first environmental laws here in New Mexico were the acequia laws.
Now, let's talk about the roots of acequias in the old world. You've been to Spain, if I understand correctly, to study acequias there. How are the acequias in Spain similar to or different from the ones here?
There are probably more similarities than differences. Certainly, we know that the Islamic people, the Arabic people from North Africa, and the Berbers and Moors and other you know, people from Middle East, Syria, Iran, Egypt, you know, moved to North Africa, and from there it was a short distance to Iberia, and in fact settled in Iberia for some seven centuries in the south of Spain, and they in fact are the ones that greatly expanded the agricultural oasis, if you will, of the deserts, you know, of southern Spain, by the use of these acequias. As we know, acequia itself is an Arabic term, still survives and still used here in New Mexico, and is sort of like as a monument to this kind of a legacy, this connection to Arabic Islamic irrigation, you know, in the south of Spain for 700 years, which remained intact even after the Christians took back the south of Spain. One of the first things that was done was to recognize and protect the irrigation and agriculture and acequias that had already been constructed and expanded on by the Arabic people. And so that sort of legacy then was brought to the New World and replicated here in the desert environments that we have. Basically, the idea of diverting water by way of an earthen canal, an acequia, and using local available materials to construct the presa. And so the technology of how to get the water out from the stream and move it alongside the ditches, and how to divide the water along these ideas about repartimiento and the dividing of waters with these structures called partidores, those are all still a legacy going back to the irrigation technology and systems of southern Spain.
Dr. Rivera, what was it like for you as a New Mexican to go to Spain to study? Did you feel at home there? Did you feel like this was your own, somehow your own people? Did it feel foreign? Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I often tell my friends that if I had to travel anywhere in Europe, of course, Spain would be my first choice. For one thing, the language was there, and even simple things like, you know, renting a car or going to the bank or going in and out of restaurants and stores and so forth just facilitated, you know, the ability for me to do the work that I needed to do, you know, a lot better, you know, compared to if I had landed somehow in Germany or even France or another country. So certainly the and then, of course, looking for these the same kind of systems, that was the search that I was on. And in fact, with made friends over there very quickly, and we then started these trips, you know, to go acequia hunting, and that's actually what we would do, especially on the weekends when we had a little bit more time to go into the countryside of places in Valencia and in Murcia and later on in Andalusia. And so we, went to the rural villages, which is where you're going to find many of these similar kinds of systems as you find here in New Mexico. The language of the acequia, of course, is directly there, either in exact words or cognates of the same words. And in fact, the water official over there typically is the acequiero. And very quickly, if you look at what the duties are of the acequiero, they're the same duties of the mayordomo here in New Mexico. They also have a Tribunal de las Aguas de la Vega de Valencia, and a similar one, El Consejo de Hombres Buenos in Murcia, who function basically as the judges and the commissioners, you know, who ultimately hear conflicts or resolve disputes and mediate disputes across the members. And I was fortunate enough to be able to sit in on one of the tribunal, you know, sessions there at the cathedral in Valencia. So that very day, the person who was brought before the water court, was claimed that he'd taken water out of turn, which then, of course, violated the ordinance for that particular ditch. And same thing as happens here in New Mexico. Basically, a person who's found guilty of violating the acequia rules is punished by way of a fine, you know, called a multa. And that's what happened to this irrigator in Valencia.
So the acequias there are alive and well. They're being used. People are using them to irrigate the way we do and did here in New Mexico.
To a large extent, yes. However, one difference is that, Spain, of course, being an older country than here as far as urban settlements are concerned, the urban acequias have disappeared in many places. Valencia, for example, was a heavily agricultural place. You know, it had an urbanized area of about 50,000 people in the central city when it was a medieval city under a wall and a fortress kind of design in the perimeter. But all of the outlying areas were huertas. These were vast land holdings that grew the wheat in order to make the bread for the medieval city, and grew all the other crops, vegetables in particular, you know, to feed the people in the medieval city. But as Valencia grew, then the process of urbanization, you know, took out many of the acequias. The seven major ones are still there, but sometimes they go underneath streets or they go underneath buildings. They come out in another area, and you see only pockets of huertas now in the large city of Valencia. So that is one of the differences, that some of the acequias in the south of Spain have now been turned over to development and have been paved over. But you have to go into the smaller places, the villages, and the countryside in order to find them.
I love the idea that you were going out with your friends acequia hunting.
Mm-hmm.
That mm-hmm. sounds so great. Now, how relevant are acequias today in northern New Mexico, given a much larger population, different farming methods, so-called modernization? Do they still have a place?
I think so. We may see a mixture happening already. You know, we all know about the Santa Cruz Farms that's owned by Don Bustos. He has what I call, my own word for it, is a hybrid farm. He uses the traditional acequia. He has a compuerta off of the acequia that runs through his community in Santa Cruz. And he also flood irrigates parcel of, you know, in his land, you know, but he also uses drip irrigation, and he also uses hoop houses or greenhouses to plant, you know, start plants early and move them into the fields and then eventually get them into the growers markets here in Santa Fe and other places. He also has contracts, you know, where people actually, you know, enter into agreements with him to be able to purchase, you know, vegetables that he grows. He has vegan crops, you know, that he grows, for example. And so I think we're going to see more of that, more intensive uses of those small parcels of acequia farms that we still have, and probably a mixture of technology, some old gravity flow still in use. For example, people who have grass and alfalfa and apple orchards still prefer the gravity flow irrigation that puts water directly where you need it and when you need it. And it recharges the aquifer. It also replenishes, you know, the trees that grow alongside the ditch banks and so forth. But we're also, I think, going to see some more drip irrigation. It's sort of an experiment right now going on, and it's always a local decision. The farmer who wants to try it will try it, and some will and maybe some won't. So I think there is some of that going on. Also, I think a better marketing. I think the fact that there are a number of growers and farmers markets here in the Santa Fe area, Santa Fe, Los Alamos, Taos, Española, I think that's a good sign. We see more people interested in, you know, connecting the urban life, you know, people in the city wanting access to freshly grown and locally produced crops and vegetables that use, you know, acequia water. Acequia water, for the most part, is clean, and the farmers do not use fossil fuels. They do not use insecticides or pesticides in the growing of their products. So we think that there's this makes for a better you know, marketing of the crops that they grow, and I think we're going to see more of that in years to come.
Dr. Jose Rivera is a research scholar at the Center for Regional Studies at the University of New Mexico and a professor of planning at the School of Architecture and Planning. He's author of the book Acequia Culture, Water, Land, and Community in the Southwest, and he will be speaking on Tuesday, July 17th, in the Water Matters Lecture Series, sponsored by Amigos Bravos, and that is at the Randall Davies Audubon Center. It's at 7 in the evening. The History and Importance of Acequias in New Mexico. Dr. Rivera, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Steven Novitsky. He is Executive Director of Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, and that it's the 40th anniversary season. It starts on July 15th. Welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here once again.
Now, this is, you've been here for almost a decade. You've been doing music festivals for over three decades. And once again, an amazing, super packed season. And we have to ask you, what are some of the musical highlights? And there's also a kind of scientific highlight going on, too. But what are some of the musical highlights?
Well, we begin this Sunday. And as many of your listeners know, for this season, our artist in residence is Alan Gilbert, who is the brilliant music director of the New York Philharmonic. And Alan will be joining us as a conductor and as a musician. He'll be playing violin and viola in some pieces, including the Mendelssohn Octet and a Brahms string sextet. And he'll be conducting the two chamber symphonies of Arnold Schoenberg. And don't let that name scare you, because these are remarkably great pieces. The first chamber symphony is an early piece of Schoenberg. It's very romantic and very passionate. And the second chamber symphony is just a neoclassical delight. And he'll be having an ensemble of some of the finest players in the country, in fact in the world, performing with him on those two pieces. And then in August, he'll also be conducting one of the most rarely heard pieces of Richard Strauss, and that's his Wind Sonatina number 1 for 16 winds, which is subtitled From an Invalid's Workshop. And Alan will be conducting a truly all-star wind ensemble for that performance. So Alan Gilbert, who many of you know from his years at the Santa Fe Opera, both as a musician and then as the music director, will be our guest our artist in residence this year.
Often your artist in residence is a composer.
Well, we have composers who are here regularly. The artist in residence program we started about three summers ago when Susan Graham was our first artist in residence. Last year, Dawn Upshaw was with us. And this year it's Alan, and next year we have another wonderful artist-in-residence for 2013.
Whom you haven't announced yet.
No, actually, everyone will be seeing it because the 2013 preview brochures will be at the first concert, and the 2013 artist-in-residence will be the wonderful American pianist Garrick Olson.
Oh, okay. Now, did you choose the Strauss piece partly because there's a Strauss opera in Santa Fe this year?
No, it's something that Alan has been wanting to conduct some of the large Strauss wind pieces. There's two of the late ones, and we had such great players available to us coming in for the festival that it just worked out to do this late work of Strauss.
I think one thing that people forget or may not be cognizant of is that The Chamber Music Festival, it goes from July 15th through the 20th of August. So it's over a month of back-to-back concerts. Probably nobody, but perhaps you, can see them all, can hear them all. But there are so many absolutely first-rate players that if your whole entire season was that one concert, it would make it worthwhile.
Well, we have, on average, between 8 and 10 concerts a week for 5.5 weeks. And so there's well over 40 concerts during the season. We have three in Albuquerque at the Sims Performing Arts Center at the Albuquerque Academy, and the rest of the concerts here in Santa Fe at St. Francis Auditorium in the New Mexico Museum of Art and at the Lenzic. And there are days when we have two and sometimes even three events in a day.
Right.
So it's a real festival where someone can come in and spend a few days and hear a vast amount of music. And over 100 musicians are with us this summer. There's so much going on. Virtually every musical taste from Baroque to a piece. Our opening night will have a piece by the young British composer Helen Grime that we commissioned, and that will be getting its world premiere. So it's everything from Bach to something that none of us have ever heard before.
Usually you also have at least one thing that is totally outside of what people normally think of as classical or chamber music.
Right, and this year it's Tiempo Libre, the Cuban band. And they're fantastic. I don't know, you've heard them before, I trust, since you're into that kind
of
music.
Right, yeah.
And they'll be joining us at the Lenzic on the 17th of August. It's a Friday night at 8 o'clock at the Lenzic. It's the Friday that begins Indian Market.
Right.
And it should be really exciting.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tiempo Libre. You also are having, we're going to talk about this in another show, but a symposium and some public lectures also called Music, the Brain, Medicine, and Wellness, a scientific dialogue. What's that all about?
Well, first of all, it's going to be a very important meeting of researchers and physicians and other kinds of therapists who all work in the field of music and the brain from different angles. So they'll all be coming together for that discussion. But at the same time, it's a really great place for people who are not scientists to immerse themselves in learning about how we love the music we love. What is it that gives us goosebumps? In fact, one of our scientists specializes in that side of the field. What is it that gives you the feeling of emotion when you hear music that you love? Why some people get goosebumps, let's say, at the end of the Mahler Sixth Symphony, and some people get it when they hear a rock concert. I mean, just, he's going to talk about that. That's David Huron. And on the same day, on Sunday, August 5th, this is at 3:30 in the afternoon at St. Francis Auditorium, Ani Patel, who's a fellow at the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego, who basically works on the theory of how the brain processes music and language, and he's going to talk about why humans respond to a beat. And his talk is calling Feeling the Beat, Are Humans Unique, and what other kinds of animals actually respond to rhythmic beats.
So, oh my goodness.
He'll have a couple of percussionists up there with him. And
then, I want to know, do you know the answer?
I don't know the answer. I'm looking forward to it. We met with him in September, and everything he said was just so interesting. I just want you and everyone to know that while we're calling it a scientific symposium, there's so much for non-scientists to learn. If you love music, there's something to gain from this. And we do have a website for the symposium. It's musicandthebrainsantafe.org. And on that site, you can see information. There's ways to register. There's ways to register just for one day rather than for the 2.5-day symposium. And you can call our office to find out about these public lecture recitals. We have one on Friday, the 3rd of August, that begins the symposium, and that's called When Music Sings, the Brain Listens and the Heart Modulates. And that's going to be with Dr. Kamal Shamali, who does a lot of work with music and cognition and music in the brain, along with pianist Prisca Benoit. So they will be doing a presentation that they've done all over the world about what it is that touches us when we hear music.
Very important and very interesting. And I think there's kind of among some people, this idea that some kinds of music are healthy and other kinds are unhealthy. And I would like to ask, and I hope we are able to get this person on the air, whether if you love some kind of music and another person hates it, whether they have completely opposite effects on that person's body.
I don't know. I'm looking forward to learning about it. I'm not a scientist. I'm a musician.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, people that are interested in music, that want to know why it touches them, why is it that you're so drawn to a certain kind of music, and why sometimes we're drawn to very disparate kinds of music.
Right.
You know, classical music and country music, or Bulgarian bagpipe music and Latin music. So it's going to be fascinating to find out about what it is that touches us with music.
Do you get to play during Chamber Music Festival?
No, I don't. I'm way too busy as the executive director. My
right.
playing has been in the winter seasons, and I'm about to back off on most of my playing. It's about time to do that.
We're talking to Stephen Ovitzky about the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, which starts on Sunday, the 15th of July. And one of the things that I appreciate about the festival is that you make it really accessible to people. There are more and less expensive concerts. There are more and less expensive seats. There are open rehearsals that people can wander into. Mm-hmm. There are lunchtime concerts. Basically, if you don't go, it isn't because
right,
anyone's excluding you.
Well, if, for example, you can't really afford to buy a ticket to any of our concerts, even our lower price Bach Plus concerts or our noon concerts or the lower price tickets at the Lenzic, then there are free open rehearsals. And that rehearsal schedule is posted on the bulletin board at St. Francis Auditorium. It's on our website. You can call our telephone number and press extension 3 and get the week's open rehearsal schedule. And of course, since they are rehearsals, they're subject to change at any time. So
right.
they're not performances.
What are the Bach Plus concert?
Bach Plus is a way to get Baroque music into the festival, and we have concerts Saturday afternoons at 5 o'clock. They run about an hour to an hour and 15 minutes with no intermission at a low ticket price. And we have programs that include a big Vivaldi spectacular on August 11th. We have a program of 4 Bach keyboard concertos with the wonderful pianist Inan Barnaton. There's just a whole wide range of mostly Baroque music on the Bach Plus. And the reason it says Plus is because sometimes it's not all Bach.
Right.
But those are great programs. The audiences love them. And for people interested in more information about the festival, we do have, of course, a website at santafechambermusic.com. Or you can call our wonderful ticket office people at 982-1890.
They are wonderful.
They are. They really do a great
They're
job.
They're nice people. They do a great job. And if anyone's listening out of area, toll-free is 888-221-9836. Stephen Ovitzky, Executive Director of Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure. We'll see you at concerts.
Excellent.